I'm speaking to Nigel Ralph here in the Green on Red Gallery. Nigel, this exhibition is entitled Life Without Life. Perhaps you could tell me where that concept came from.
The actual text is a copy of the text used by the Nazis, which was life unworthy of life, which were all the categories of people that they put in the final solution that they wanted to get rid of because they weren't quite perfect. And it's a discussion really of why we place certain things of worth and things not of worth, and then what is worthy and what isn't worthy. And my interest is with very fragile, broken, transient things, because I make performances and I'm known for doing it for many years. That territory is really a territory of transience. Nothing remains, nothing is important in terms of a static object. And this set of work of dried old flowers, I think when I've been writing my notes, I've been thinking that it's an extremely perverse thing to try and do, to keep hold of them beyond the time that nature would have allowed. So a kind of preservation of something imperative in their fragility. And the stitch together of this exhibit is the relationship between the notion of that kind of fascist text, these dead flowers, and then the idea of the loss of human life. And this year has been such an incredible year in terms of world history in relationship to the rebirth of a fascism and then a kind of super militarism as some way of dealing with it. And it seemed important to try and mark it in some way as a tribute, really, or as a kind of lament. And I mean, it's a difficult stitch together. You know, you take dead flowers, which are still lives. You take a subsequent Nazi text, and you take the idea of memorial of people, and whether or not those three things hang together, and probably the glue which sticks them together here is the soundtrack. The soundtrack is the chemistry for the presentation of that thesis. I'm not so sure myself. I'm not so sure whether it does hang together completely, whether the notion, the longing for that to be, is more important than it actually conjoining, but certainly the aspiration for it is in those terms. That is my thinking, absolutely.
There's a strange kind of conflict when you sit in the space between the images, which are quite brittle and cold and dead, and the music, which often has a womb-like kind of feeling, and there's a sort of heartbeat going through it.
Yeah, I'm well known in the performance art fraternity, I think, as one of the first people over about 25 years who always referred back to my own body and thence the heartbeat in soundtracks as a kind of measured device. Other people like Meredith Monk, Laurie Anderson in America, number of performance artists have always referred to it. I've been working with it for a long time. It's become a cliche, but if it comes from your practice and it's a kind of authentic thinking, you try and resist the cliches which are addressed to it. So many other people using them nowadays, I'm somewhat suspect of. In this case, it's actually a drumming, and it's drumming done with a knowledge of the heartbeat, but mainly as a rhythmic parameter of the track itself. I think the sound does engulf you. The very particular use of a kind of Slavic choral sampling, the relationship of church music and the idea of the kind of dark church, all that thinking, I think, relates to the idea of being enclosed in some womb. And I think the very difficult thing of actually making a blacked-out room, a very large blacked-out room right in the height of summer, adds to the perversity. And I think when you enter that dark room, you enter a kind of womb-like sense. You can't see, you're lost. And then the relationship of this architecture of the flowers, this kind of cool, distant, and indeed very brittle, very fragile, really. I keep referring myself to the idea of the broken. They're at the point where they're broken beyond the potential of ever being able to be fixed. So what we've gotten into some very good discussions here in the last couple of weeks with critics and some writers, you know, the fact that you're always giving dead flowers as a tribute, you know, for a birth or for a wedding or for, and then for death. But in fact, those cut flowers you've savaged by cutting them at the neck, actually dictating their end. And there's something very odd in that. Like, you savage them, you castrate them, you bind them up. And if you were making that reference in anything else, if you were doing that to an animal, you would be thought of as an utter masochist or an utter a pervert of some sort. But if you're doing it to a flower, it's an association of your freedom by its demise. And there, and I know a lot of musical tracks from the 30s onwards about, you know, don't send me dead flowers in the morning, show me signs that you're living. So that notion, and then keeping them way beyond their due date, like in some cases here, they're 10 years old. They would never have that state of preservation and be held. And then to kind of glorify them by over-documenting them, taking them out of scale, coming in very close to see a sub-world, an architecture underneath what you would normally perceive, dabbling in some kind of control, some systems of control. I think talking like this, those are all the ingredients. You know, whether or not you'll move somewhere else, most people seem to respond by going to a third state, wanting to keep looking and listening, but being in another state. And that's where I think the art lies. I think the art lies in a third state. You know, not the algebra of how it's constructed, but in a condition of otherness. And I suppose that's what really interests me, but I'm least happy to ever talk about. You learn a kind of knack at dealing with that, which puts it outside yourself. You know, but you're very well aware of what that presence, questions of absence and presence, really. A great sense of being somewhere, but being utterly devoid of knowing where quite you are. And I think good art for me operates always in that parameter. You know, it takes you away and it absolutely locates you, but you don't know where you've been located and you don't know where you've been taken away to or from. And I think those are the characteristics.
Okay. Just finally, perhaps you could tell me about the people who are involved in the soundtrack, the making of the soundtrack.
I've been working for a very long time in Dublin with some of the middle generation but kind of rock and experimental musicians. It's Greg Boland playing guitar and John Donnelly the drummer, and then myself on samples and keyboards. It's live played, 7 minutes long, and generated as a kind of spiritual locator of the text of the exhibit, of trying to work out what you're talking about in relationship to that notion of fascism and militarism right now in 1999. But I find that community in Dublin really particularly enriching. I've worked with them certain knowledge about 15 years, and it's odd for them. It's not a normal gig. Dealing with a performance artist who is known to be wacky or more difficult. But I find them spiritually very, very centered. And it's as strong as it is because of the centering between us, the kind of cooperation and then the discussion. That's how you make music. They're very under-celebrated here. We have a marvellous, strong core of both traditional and experimental musicians who I find in their middle years have a more difficult life. They don't find it that easy. They're not that well paid, but they're terribly, terribly good. And those two guys, the two I'm working with, are extremely good. Not only do they understand recording, they also understand content. And that leap of faith for someone, I think, is really large. It's where creativity lies.
All right, well, thank you very, very much.
Good, thank you.